Welcome everybody to the fifth and final lecture for the Mises Academy class, Economics of the Great Depression. This is lecture five on the lessons, in quotation marks, of 1937 and the myth of wartime prosperity. Okay, so let me spend a few moments just walking through what is both the Keynesian and the monetarist narrative here. So, well, first of all, let me just make sure you guys didn't miss the fact that there wasn't one uninterrupted Great Depression all through the 1930s. That there was what's called the Great Contraction. And when I say called, I mean like economists talk about this. It's not that if you're like a European student and I'm talking like this, it doesn't mean that Americans walk around referring to the Great Contraction. They don't. They just call it the Great Depression. But what I'm saying is economists who talk about this period will often break it up. And they'll say, so there's the Great Contraction from 29 to 33, and then there was an apparent robust recovery from 33 to 37. And what do I mean by that? That if you look at a lot of conventional measures, like real GDP in particular and unemployment, they seem to be moving in the right direction, and in fact rapidly so, according to some analysts. But then there was the depression within the depression. Is what it's sometimes called. All right, so in which real GDP again contracted and unemployment shot back up again. Okay, so this is what we're trying to explain, and it's because of these changing tides in the fortunes of the U.S. economy in the 1930s that a lot of Keynesians and monetarists think that their own explanation of what went wrong and then their policy prescriptions for today, in terms of our current Great Recession, are valid. Okay, so it's, in other words, the Keynesians and the monetarists think that, or they're very sure that they're right, and they believe that their views are grounded in empirical reality, that it's not just ideology, or it's not just some abstract model that looks internally consistent but hasn't been tested against the real world, because they're saying, look at my model can explain why the economy turned around quickly in 1933, and it can also explain why the economy then went into this double dip or depression within the depression in 37, 38. And so, that, in other words, they think that they can call both turning points, and so therefore it seems obvious to them that their solution or their analysis is correct. Okay, so in case you don't know who these people are, let me just make sure. So this woman is Christina Romer. So she was an academic economist. I think Peter Klein actually studied under her. I don't know if she was literally his professor or was on his committee or anything, but I am almost positive that he has like heard lectures from her where he got his degree. And then she was the head of the Council of Economic Advisors for Barack Obama when he first came into office, and she was the author of what could be construed as the infamous economic analysis of the American Recovery and Reinvestment Act, more popularly known as the Obama Stimulus Package. So that was, so she's the one who wrote that, or was the lead author on, I don't know how much of it she actually did, but her name was on it, saying that when President Obama came in and that big stimulus package that went through and showed the infamous chart that you may have seen, looking at what unemployment would be in the two scenarios, one with without the stimulus package and then one with the stimulus package. And it's just funny that they were warning that if they did nothing, unemployment might get as high as like almost 9%, like if you ate something. And then they were saying, but you know, if we do this, then it won't break 8. And they're, and of course, what happened is in reality, they got the stimulus package and unemployment went higher than what they were warning people would happen if the government did nothing. And so a lot of people, including me, had a field day with that, saying, you know, these guys say how empirical they are. What would the facts need to be in order for them to start doubting their theory? But in any event, she was very loud meaning in the public's eye, beating the drums for the need for stimulus, which makes sense because, you know, she was the chief economist, Council of Economic Advisors for the White House. And then, of course, this guy over here, I'm sure you guys all know, is Paul Krugman. I'll get to the middle guy in a minute, but let's focus on the Keynesians right now. So Romer and Krugman, and other people were doing it, but I knew them well because I read their stuff when they were writing at the time. So that what they were telling the American public in 2009 and 2010 was that we need to look at the lessons of the Great Depression and not make the same mistakes. And so they said, in particular, the problems of the Great Depression of the 1930s was that Herbert Hoover tried to balance the budget, and that's why things were so awful under him. Then Franklin Roosevelt came into office, and as we all know, in March of 33, and he ran big budget deficits, and you saw perhaps the fastest recovery in economic history in terms of the turnaround and just the growth of real GDP. And then, alas, their story continues, their explanation for what happened in the 1930s. Roosevelt's advisors convinced him that he was piling up government debt too quickly, and so they tried to, they had a move towards fiscal austerity in 1937. So in other words, when Roosevelt first came into office, he was willing to borrow a ton of money and run big deficits because the economy was so bad. But then once it looked like things were improving and people stopped thinking that the world was going to end, then more and more people were sounding the alarm about these chronic budget deficits and that, hey, we can't keep piling up debt like this. And so, unfortunately, FDR caved in to their demands, and he agreed to contractionary austerity measures in terms of fiscal policy. And then look what happened. We got the Depression within the Depression. All right, so that's the narrative that Romer and Krugman were telling people. And so they were saying, let's not make the same mistake now. Obama came in. He gave us a big stimulus package. It wasn't enough, but it averted catastrophe. All right, so they're saying if Obama hadn't run such a big deficit, we would have had the Second Great Depression. It was the size of that deficit that spared us. You know, it wasn't as big as Krugman wanted, because if it had been as big as Krugman wanted, we would already have 5% unemployment. We would have been back to normal. So it wasn't enough, but at least it was a shot in the arm, and it spared us having a repeat, literally, of the Great Depression. But these Republicans, these Austrian economists and all these right wingers keep warning everybody about the deficit, and they keep pointing to the figures showing how big the U.S. government's debt to GDP ratio is growing. And if we make a premature move to try to balance the budget, we're going to slide back into a severe recession. And so that's what they're saying. And they say, look at the 1930s proved that. Okay, a somewhat similar story is offered by guys like Scott Sumner. That's who, oops, I wasn't trying to That wasn't a passive-aggressive thing. I wasn't trying to draw a line through him. I just dropped the pen there. All right, so his name is Scott Sumner, S-U-M-N-E-R. And I'm just picking him to be a modern representative of the monetarist view. Sumner, you guys don't need to know this for this course. I'm just giving you a little background. He's actually one of the leading proponents of what's now called market monetarism, which is a sort of tweaking of traditional monetarism as developed by Milton Friedman. Okay, so, but when I speak here of what the monetarists say, I'm using it as a, in a broad term. So I'm including people who liked what Milton Friedman had to say, and then even people who now are followers of Scott Sumner who might, you know, endorse specific policy recommendations that aren't the exact thing that Milton Friedman talked about. That, you know, Sumner thinks that his thing is more sophisticated than what Friedman did, but he thinks he's building on the legacy and the pioneering work of Friedman. So remember, what the monetarists think happened in the 1930s was that there wasn't enough money growth, that the Fed was too tight. And specifically, it's not that the Fed deliberately in 1928 and 29 and, well, in the Great Contraction, it's not that the Fed deliberately tried to be contractionary. It's just that they were tied to the gold standard and there were some other things that they just, you know, their theories were bad, according to the monetarists. Like some people may have thought they actually were being expansionary because interest rates were dropping. But Friedman and then just the monetarists in general say, look at something like M2 or M1 that includes demand deposits at commercial banks, and because the public was running on the banks and all these banks are failing, the actual quantity of money using that definition, that aggregate that would include commercial demand deposits, actually shrank pretty significantly from 29 to 33. So what the Fed should have done was to inflate on its end so much that it compensated for the public's changed preferences about holding currency as opposed to holding their wealth or their money in the form of bank deposits. All right, so that's what Milton Friedman said happened and explained why 29 through 33 was so awful. Now when it comes to the double dip, 37-38, the monitors here, they've got a pretty good trump card. They can say that from 36 to 37, the Fed doubled reserve requirements. All right, so that's a pretty good thing to point to if you're a monetarist and you want to explain, gee, why did the economy sink back into depression in 37, 38? They can point and say, well, because the Fed doubled the reserve requirements. So remember, what do we mean by reserve requirements? There's a fractional reserve banking system. So that means the commercial bank, it for all of the customer checking account balances, demand deposits, I'm speaking loosely, only a certain percentage of that has to be in the vault or on deposit with the Fed as reserves. So like if it's 10%, then if the customers collectively have $1 billion worth of checking account balances with that bank, right, so if you asked each customer and said, hey, how much is in your checking account? And one guy says, oh, $400. Another guy says $1,600. Well, so the two of them together think that there's $2,000 on deposit with that commercial bank. Okay, so I'm saying if you added up all those numbers from all the customers and they all collectively thought they had $1 billion immediately available that they could write checks on, they could go to the ATM, get cash out, so forth, at that bank, then a 10% reserve requirement means the bank has to have either in cash in the vault or on deposit with the Fed, $100 million. So there's 10% of a reserve that the bank has to have so that meaning if 10% of the customers wanted to pull their money out, the bank could satisfy them. Okay, so what happened is, for various reasons, Fed officials began to get worried about price inflation in the 30s. And there's lots of things you could say. I mean, for one thing, they took the dollar off gold, and then they revalued it, right? So the gold price of the dollar went from $20.67 when Roosevelt first took office to $35 per ounce 1 year later. So, and remember, we saw what happened with the consumer price index, that it was plummeting and then turned around on a dime and then started rising right after FDR did all that stuff. So, in any event, so just as with today, the market monitor or the monetarists are trying to relate the two, and they'll say, just like today, people are worried about price inflation, and people are worried about Bernanke, and hey, we need to tighten up. That's what happened in the 30s. And so what happened is the Fed didn't just sell off a bunch of assets in order to suck reserves out of the system, you know, because that's a standard textbook way that the Fed could tighten. What they did, I mean, they partly might have been doing that too, but one of the things they also did, which the textbooks talk about, if you've taken that kind of a course, is they raised the reserve requirements. In fact, they doubled them. So just going back to the numbers I was doing, that hypothetical example, now if the Fed says all of a sudden, you know what, we don't, it's not enough to have 10%, you got to have 20% in reserves. So now that bank that originally had $1 billion and $100 million in reserve now would need to have $200 million in reserve. So they'd have to come up with $100 million more. And so that's contractionary from the monetarist perspective. Now, the interesting thing that was happening here is, and this, again, is very similar. So I'm going to take a few moments to walk you guys through this point because it's very relevant for today, that some people thought, and even I was just Googling before we started today or tonight, just to refresh my memory about the timing and so forth. And there are economists to this day who will say the Fed doubling of the reserve requirements was not at all contractionary because the reserve requirements weren't binding. And what they mean by that is that there weren't a lot of banks who had lended out up to the original reserve requirement, which then got doubled. Okay, so they're saying what ended up happening is there were a bunch of excess reserves, and all that the doubling of the reserve requirement did was reduce the amount of excess reserves. Okay, so let me relate it to today, because there's a similar thing going on today where in the United States financial sector, there are more than $1 trillion of excess reserves right now. So what that means is the commercial banks have the legal ability to lend those reserves out, to grant new loans. And in fact, if you use the 10% reserve ratio, they could create $10 trillion more deposits, right? They could make loans of up to $10 trillion, so now those $1 trillion in reserves that are sitting there in their excess now would be required, if that makes sense, right? So it's, if you haven't walked through these kind of examples and thought about it, it might strike you as a little bit odd to think of it. But the point is, the commercial banks right now have $1 trillion in excess reserves, meaning they have these reserves, either cash in the vault or electronic deposits with the Fed, and they're excess because they haven't, you know, the total amount of money that their customers have on deposit with them, legally they only need a certain amount, and they've got way more than what they need to satisfy that reserve requirement. So a lot of people, myself included, have been warning and saying, hey, you know, when the conditions change, and the banks want to start lending that out, then we're going to have serious trouble. that so far Bernanke injecting all that money hasn't made gasoline become $20 a gallon. It hasn't pushed up a barrel of oil to be $300 a barrel. But that's partly because the these reserves are all just sitting in the banks. They're not being lent out into the broader aggregates that the public uses. Okay, so what people say then, and Bernanke has said this, and so have others, is, hey, there's no problem here. If and when the reserves, even when banks did start doing that, don't worry, Bernanke. It's not like Bernanke has to start selling off mortgage-backed securities or selling off treasuries and raising interest rates, which is what people like me are saying, that, you know, if the reserves start going out, at that point the Fed's going to have to make a decision. Are they just going to sit back and let it happen and let trillions of new dollars get created, driving up prices and weakening the dollar? Or is he going to have to undo all of the extraordinary measures that got the Fed's balance sheet so big in the first place and created all those new reserves, which would wreck the financial sector again and, you know, crash all the banks? So I was saying that's the impossible position that Bernanke is going to find himself in if these reserves start getting lent out. That right now it seems like there's no problem from him just buying up all of these toxic assets and everything and resuscitating the financial sector with all these banks that should have gone under. And it seems like, hey, he just created $1 trillion+ out of thin air, rescued all these financial institutions, and CPI measures of price inflation are pretty tame by historical standards, so it looks like it was a magic fix that and has no downside. And so, like I say, I and many other people are saying, no, it's sort of like a ticking time bomb, that all he did was postpone the problem, and it's going to be a lot worse now when we have to deal with it later. So anyway, I'm making this a bit longer than it needs to be, but I want to make sure you get the point. What people say is, no, you guys are wrong. Bernanke is not going to have to sell off mortgage-backed securities or sell off treasuries and thereby raise interest rates on government debt. That's not going to do. All he needs to do when the banks start lending out those excess reserves is just raise reserve requirements, and then they won't legally be able to do that. And so there, we're fine. And that's one of the things they did in the 30s also. So, and the issue is what happens is, it's sort of naive. It that kind of analysis, and again, people nowadays, some economists try to say that the Fed doubling of reserve requirements didn't do anything because the constraint wasn't binding, that the banks still had more reserves than they needed in the 30s. And so the modern analysts who say, so clearly the Fed doubling of that couldn't have done anything, I think they're looking at it wrong, because the point is the banks make a conscious decision to hold excess reserves, right? It's, in other words, they know what they're doing. They know they could lend that money out, and they choose not to. They like having $1 trillion plus, whatever the number is, as available cash that they could use if they wanted to, but they don't want to. They want to just sit on that. And there's various reasons they're earning a slight interest rate from the Fed and other things, and plus they just have no good loans to make. But the point is, it would affect their position or their view of the world. It would affect their portfolio if all of a sudden the government said, yeah, you know how you thought you had $1 trillion in excess reserves? Well, we just raised the reserve requirements. Now you only have $500 billion. All right, you effectively would have made the banks now feel $500 billion poorer, is what I'm trying to get at. So it's not to say that would be a bad thing. I mean, opponents of fractional reserve banking would say, yeah, they should feel poor, that they shouldn't think that they can lend that money out. They can't. Okay, so I'm not saying whether it's unfair or something. I'm just saying, though, you're not fixing the problem created by these huge amounts of excess reserves by just raising the reserve requirements. You're just transforming the way the problem manifests itself. All right, let me just give you one analogy, and then I'll move on. It would be like you're just a regular household, and you want to have an emergency fund. You know, that's a good thing. So a lot of people want to have like 3 to 6 months worth of basic expenses in cash, meaning like in the bank. That's there. It's not like it's in some sort of asset that might lose value, but they literally have liquid funds of 3 to 6 months of expenses. So they, you know, they could pay their mortgage, they could pay for food, pay their utilities and all that. So even if the breadwinners lose their jobs, they know they've got a 3 to 6 month window for them to find new work or to come up with some strategy. That's the idea. So let's say it's a typical household, and let's say their expenses are $5,000 a month, and they've got $15,000 in their savings account in the bank. All right, and I say savings, but let's say it's a checking account just to make sure it's right. So it's sitting right there. They don't touch it. That's their genuine savings. That's their emergency fund in case something happens. They got $15,000. Okay. Now, the government passes a law. This is every household in America must by law keep at least $15,000 in their checking account at all time unless there's an earthquake, and then they're allowed to spend it because we want that $15,000 to be there as an emergency fund in the case of an earthquake. And then people say, whoa, that's going to mess everybody up. And the government says, no, we're not taking anybody's money. We're just saying you have to maintain a minimum balance of $15,000 in liquid funds in your checking account because we want you to be ready in case there's an earthquake. And then you're going to thank us if there is an earthquake. You've got $15,000 right there. Okay, so just think through what that would do to everybody, or typical of the household I'm talking about. They effectively would have went from having a $15,000 emergency fund to basically having zero unless there's an earthquake, right? But if the breadwinners lose their jobs, they're not allowed to touch that money now because the government's rule says you got to keep this in here. Okay, so what they would have to do is they would have to build up another $15,000. And so somebody, after the fact, looking at their finances, might naively say, oh, well, that government regulation didn't do anything. Look, at this family has $30,000 in their checking account. So clearly the government saying you have to keep a minimum of 15 didn't affect them because they've got 30 in there. Now, you know, if they had only had 14,000 in there when the government passed that regulation, and then after they had 15,000, we could say that clearly crimped their style because they had to come up with $1,000 to meet that new statute. But since they already had 15 in there, and then on top of that new regulation, they put another 15 in there, so now they have double what they need. Clearly, they're not affected by that regulation at all. You see how silly it would be to argue like that? Okay, so that's what I'm saying happened with the commercial banks in the 30s, that the banks had more, they had excess reserves for much of the same reason that they have excess reserves today. I mean, they weren't as big because the Fed wasn't doing as crazy stuff back then as Bernanke's been doing. But they were holding those excess reserves because they weren't sure what to do with it, and they were all, I mean, it was awful. It was a Great Depression. Everyone wanted to hunker down and hold cash. And so from a bank's perspective, what does it mean to hold cash? It means you have excess reserves. You don't just lend out to the legal limit so that if your assets fall in value, then you're in trouble. Or if people default on what they owe you, now you're in serious trouble. You want to have a huge cushion. All right, I'm somewhat mixing up accounting things. I mean, because it's your capital position is different from your reserve requirements, but you get the idea, I hope, at a broad enough level here. Okay, so when the government or when the Federal Reserve then doubled those reserve requirements, the banks responded by tightening up because they wanted to have excess reserves, and so the Fed, by doubling reserve requirements, turned those excess reserves into required reserves, or a lot of them, and so now the banks all of a sudden realized they didn't have as big of a cushion as they wanted, and so they went to try to build that cushion back up. And how do you do that if you're a bank? Well, when people pay off their loans, you don't renew them. You don't make new loans because you want to shrink the amount of deposits relative to your reserves in order to make those reserves turn into excess reserves. Okay? So that's what happened there. So you can see the Keynesian monetarist narratives as to what was happening. And so by the same token then, monetarists today say it is incredibly irresponsible for people like Ron Paul and these Austrian nut jobs to be talking about going back on gold and let's start selling off, let's shrink the Fed's balance sheet and let's start raising interest rates. That's crazy, because look what happened in the 30s when the Fed tightened. You got this double dip. Okay, so you can see in this chart that I'm looking at now that there really was, you know, objectively a tightening by the Fed in terms of the monetary base. So you can see how there was a gentle little decline in the 29, early 30s, and then started rising again. And then remember, this spike right here is what we looked at when we were talking about the gold standard. And now look at what happened here. You see that? So this is why people were concerned, various Fed officials. That right after Roosevelt came in and took the dollar off gold and then revalued it, there was a pretty substantial increase in the monetary base. And then it leveled off, and then there was this collapse. All right, so this is what the modern monetarists are talking about. And saying, see, you shouldn't be surprised in this gray area of the recession. So you could also, this is another way of pointing it out. So this right here is the what I call the great contraction. You see that from 29 to 33. But then in this area, it's white because they're saying from 33 to 37 was actually an expansion. So that was when real gross domestic product was growing. But then it sank again in this period. Okay. So of the two theories, just to give you my own personal views, the Keynesian story to me makes no sense at all. Like we'll see in a minute, it doesn't even fit the numbers. It's just goofy. Whereas the monetarist story, I can more understand where they're coming from. Now, you know, in terms of my broader perspective, I show you guys looking at 1920 and 21 and explaining the role of the federal government in preventing nominal wages from falling and all that kind of stuff. So it's, I think the monetarists are wrong, but I can understand why they would think that. Whereas the Keynesian story, like I said, you just have to, in my mind, be willfully blind to the facts and just be so sure ideologically that Keynesianism is correct in order to look at the numbers and walk away thinking, yeah, the 30s bolster my position. I think it was in the Christina Romer article that I signed you guys where she says something that's just so shockingly misleading, and I don't know, it's hard to know some of these people, if she knew very well what the data were, and so she was carefully stepping around the landmines to not say something that was demonstrably false, but yet highly misleading, or if it was an honest mistake. But the point is, she said something like, she's talking about why we're great under FDR from 33 to 37. So in order for that to make sense, and she's going to say it's because of budget deficits. So in order for that to make sense, that story, that narrative, she has to show that Herbert Hoover was had low budget deficits. Otherwise, the story wouldn't make any sense. And so the way she phrased it, and this might not be an exact quote, but it was something like, she said, when FDR came in, it was a bold experimentation and a willingness to run much larger peacetime budget deficits than had been done before. Certainly the norm before FDR had been balanced budgets. Okay, so that's not a lie. That's a true statement. But she leads the reader to believe that Herbert Hoover had a balanced budget. I mean, she didn't literally say that, but she said before FDR did this, the norm was for balanced budgets. So that makes you think Herbert Hoover was just like everybody else, when we've seen, no, he wasn't. Herbert Hoover was the one who deviated from the norm. Herbert Hoover was the one who ran big budget deficits. And so I showed you in this chart right here, just to get a sense of how ridiculous this claim is. So the last year, so fiscal year 1933, and remember, fiscal years at that time were, they started on July 1st. Okay, so fiscal 33 was July 1st, 1932 to June, I forget how many days are in June, whatever, it's either 30 or 31. So I'll put a little of, 33. Okay, and remember also the other adjustment is presidents back then were sworn in on March 4th. Okay, so Franklin Roosevelt isn't sworn in as president until, it's 30, thank you. So June 30th. So Franklin Roosevelt didn't become the president until March 4th, 1933. So that's why I'm saying fiscal year 1933 is appropriately classified as being, as belonging to, Herbert Hoover rather than FDR. In case you guys are wondering why am I saying 1933 belongs to Hoover when FDR was elected in 32. Just remember that timing. Okay, so what I'm saying is Romer's claim is the reason the economy, we had the worst contraction in U.S. history from 29 to 33 because of Herbert Hoover's tight-fisted budget austerity, and then the reason we had, in her description, the biggest economic expansion or strongest recovery, she used phrases to those effect, from 34 to 37 was because of FDR's bold willingness to run big budget deficits. And so that's what I say, if you look at these numbers, Herbert Hoover's last one was 4.5% of GDP, and over this period where Romer is saying that's the model for what we need to do is bold policy experimentation and so forth, it averaged 5.1%. So it was bigger in 34, you know, it was higher than the average. So going from Hoover's last year to FDR's first year, the way if you're going to divide the fiscal years up, there was a bigger jump than just 60 basis points. But the point is, that's kind of a small difference, wouldn't you say, to explain going from the worst period in U.S. economic history to what Romer is saying is the biggest recovery, that a deficit of 4.5% of GDP is what let the economy plunge to having 25% unemployment, but, we just boosted the deficit up to 5.1% of GDP for a three-year period on average, and that's what was pulling us out of the depths of the Great Depression because of those huge deficits. You see what I'm saying? That can't be right. That's too subtle of an effect. And Romer doesn't say this in her article, because if she did, it would look absurd on the face of it. Like I said, the way she phrased it, technically what she said was not false, but it led you to believe, if you didn't know what the numbers were, you would certainly have thought Herbert Hoover had a balanced budget in every year of his administration, or tried to, and you know, came close and maybe just missed it, but he was trying to. So in the one thing that they can say to try to defend this view that Herbert Hoover was this austerian kind of guy is that it is true, remember, so in 1932 Hoover did try to reduce the deficit. So that is true, that his advisors, you know, had convinced him that his budget deficit is too big. And remember, in the 32 campaign, the Democratic Party's platform said they were going to balance the budget, and FDR in his speeches was lambasting Herbert Hoover for being a reckless spender. All right, so remember that context too, just the irony of what Romer's trying to do here. But it is true that Hoover, he did try to reduce the deficit, but the spending cuts were trivial. It was like $100 million and change. And the bulk of what they were trying to do was through tax increases. And I already in a previous lecture showed you the just inconceivably high rate increases that the Hoover administration implemented. Where, like, for example, the top marginal income tax bracket went from 25% to 63% in a single year. I mean, that's inconceivable. Where right now, remember, where people are freaking out about it going from 35 to 39, and it went from 25 to 63. So, that, I mean, that's just incredible when you think about it. All right, so, so that's, and that's another thing, too, that Krugman and Romer do not stress. They say how Hoover, in other words, they frame that as Hoover reducing the deficit or trying to. Because what ended up happening, in case you guys are getting confused, the budget deficit as a share of GDP actually increased because the GDP fell even more, and because you know, the revenue increases weren't what they thought they were going to be because the economy was so awful. Okay, so that's why the budget deficit as a share of GDP went up, even though Hoover tried to balance the budget, tried to reduce the budget deficit. I don't know if they were actually thinking they were going to balance the budget, but they were trying to shrink the deficit. Okay, so, but the way Krugman and Romer describe that to the readers is saying a move towards a balanced budget. They don't explain how the vast bulk of what was supposed to happen, the way that they were going to reduce the deficit, was by raising taxes, because Krugman's all about raising taxes on rich people, right? So that's what I'm saying. They're very crafty about how they talk about what happened in the 30s to give the innocent reader a totally different impression of what happened. Krugman and his and Romer, if you just relied on their summaries, you would think Herbert Hoover slashed spending like crazy in 1932, and he didn't. Okay. Oops. So let me, is there anything else I want to talk about this? Well, why don't I move on? Because I do want to leave time for your questions, and I want to walk slowly through the myth of wartime prosperity. Okay, so I think you guys have all heard these views, but just to make sure I'm not leaving anybody behind, the idea, of course, is that it's extremely popular in the United States for people to say, and maybe foreign students can tell us whether this is true in other countries, for people to say World War II got us out of the Depression. People say that all the time. And the irony is, even conservatives who hate FDR say this. Right? So a lot of times you will hear people say things like, oh, it wasn't the New Deal that got us out of the Depression. It was World War II. Okay, so just think about why that helps them, because they want to discredit, you know, the big government economic intervention of the New Deal. And so I respect that. I want to discredit it also. And but they have to, you know, they don't know how to explain the fact that we had the Great Depression. It clearly, the New Deal clearly didn't get rid of it. Remember in the last lecture I showed you the unemployment figures. They were still in double digits as of 1939, when, you know, Roosevelt had already been in office for six full years at that point. So, you know, what would it have to look like if the New Deal just prolonged the Depression and made it agonizing? Wouldn't it look like what we actually saw happen in actual history? Another point, incidentally, I didn't make this in the last lecture, but just a little side point. If you got my book, I give you the numbers and I walk you through it. But another interesting way to see that the New Deal didn't help is if you plot U.S. unemployment rates next to Canadian unemployment rates and look at the gap. And you can see that the gap increased after FDR came into office. Okay, so no matter how you do it, whether you do it saying compare the U.S. recovery under FDR to previous recoveries from financial crashes and panics and so forth, clearly the recovery under FDR was awful. Or if you compare the U.S. under FDR to Canada under its governing policies at the same time, and you see that Canada bounced back from the depths of the Great Depression faster than the U.S. did in the same time period. See, no matter, because some people try to make excuses for FDR and say, well, yeah, of course the U.S. wasn't going to be back to normal as of 1935 because this, you know, FDR inherited the worst thing in world history. So, of course, it's going to take a long time for him to turn that situation around. And so the point is, okay, but how come the same isn't true for the Canadian government? Because as of 1933, they also were dealing with what for them would have been the worst thing ever, and yet they bounced back more quickly. All right, so that's just another incidental way you can just look at the raw data, even if you didn't have an economic theory and just wanted to kind of say, as naively looking at the historical facts, does it look like the New Deal helped? And it's hard to see how you could possibly think that. Okay, but back to what we're talking about tonight. So a lot of conservatives, political conservatives, who tend to be Republican in the United States, they will say, oh, yeah, it wasn't the New Deal that got us out of the Depression. It was World War II. And you see, again, if you understand why they would think that and why they feel they need to say it was World War II, because in their mind, clearly, we were out of the Depression by 1941 because people had jobs, and then they know that if they do know how to look at the standard charts, you see the statistics show GDP was rising and all that stuff. And then after the war was over, we didn't go back into the Great Depression, so it's understandable that people think the Great Depression ended for the United States when the U.S. entered World War II. All right, so the irony, though, of saying that is that if they do say that, then they just conceded Keynesianism. Right? So that's, and I see some people in the comments are quibbling about the terminology. It's true. This word conservative, I'm using it in the sort of pop sense by which, like, somebody like Rush Limbaugh calls himself conservative, whereas, you know, Daniel McCarthy, who's the editor of the American Conservative, would say, no, those guys aren't actual conservatives, like of the old right. These guys are neoconservatives, and they're actually not conservative by any meaningful sense of the term. Just like people who call themselves liberal sometimes today, like what popularly people refer to as liberal by no means means a classical liberal in the sense of Bastiat. Okay, so when I say conservative here, I mean pop conservative Republican who don't like Democrats is what I'm talking about. Okay, so the point is here, the irony is that if they do say that, they're conceding that government spending fixes a depressed economy. It's just they're saying FDR didn't go far enough with his domestic spending. It took, or his spending on domestic programs, it took him to spend for fighting the Nazis in order to spend enough to get the economy out of depression. And so in doing that, they're actually echoing Paul Krugman. And so Krugman does have a point when he refers to what he calls sometimes weaponized Keynesianism. And Krugman points out that a lot of these Republican politicians in particular who have military bases in their district, and whenever there's a proposed cut to the military budget, and they flip out and say, whoa, whoa, look at all the jobs you're going to destroy in my district if you cut this program, and it's essential for national security because we build, you know, cruise missiles in this, my district here, and da-da-da, or whatever. And Krugman rightfully points out, wait a minute, when it comes to spending money building roads or bridges, you Republicans say how the government can't create jobs. It can just take money from the taxpayers and put it over here, but it doesn't create jobs. But how come when it comes to the military budget, now all of a sudden you think the government can create jobs? So he's got a good point, Krugman does, that there are hypocrites, and that's what I'm pointing out here. This popular saying among even American conservative opponents of the New Deal to say it was World War II, it's ironic that they're actually conceding Keynesian economics when they say that, even though they think they're not. Okay, let's just review a couple of the major points. So it's understandable why somebody could think this. All right, even though, on the one hand, let me put it this way. On the one hand, it's crazy. How could it possibly be the case that a war is good for the economy? Now, let me be clear, and I had to walk a fine line in my Politically Incorrect Guide to the Great Depression, because I knew that the audience they were going to market that to, a lot of them would be neoconservatives, you know, Republicans who thought the U.S. entry into World War II was one of the greatest things ever, whereas in my own views as to foreign policy and world history, I actually don't think that was a good thing. And I'm sure most of you, being fans of the Mises Institute, probably share that perspective, or at least you understand it. So the issue here, we're arguing straight economics. And so the way I phrased it in my Depression book, to make sure the reader understood, I was saying, we're not talking about whether it was a good thing for the U.S. government to create all these bombs and aircraft and battleships and aircraft carriers and so forth and tanks to go wage this fight against the Nazis and the Japanese. That's not the issue. The issue is, did it make us richer, or was it good for the economy in some sense on top of whatever benefits one might think accrued because of stopping world domination from, you know, the Axis powers or whatever. You get what I'm saying? So there's differences there. In other words, if the Nazis could have been defeated by just sending Captain America over and they had to just spend $1 million training him, or, you know, the serum or whatever that turned him into Captain America, and then he went over and by himself defeated the Nazis and everything and said, we didn't have to spend all that money, would that have been even better? So Krugman and guys like that would have to say no. Then we would still have been in the Great Depression. Or at least our economy would have been worse, but then maybe there would have been fewer casualties, and so you'd have to weigh those things. But the point is, Krugman thinks, no, it was the huge spending that got the economy out of depression, and so that part of it was good. Also, let me just give a note of warning in terms of take it how you want to, but if you say, oh, Krugman wants to start a war, or Krugman likes death and destruction, well, destruction you could argue better, but if you say Krugman likes killing people, somebody who's sympathetic to his view is going to think that that's not right. They're going to say, no, all he's saying, he's not saying it was good that they had to fight a war, he was saying they had to fight a war and they spent all that money and the money is what pulled them out. But nowadays, instead of having to have a war, since we learned what happened in World War II, now we can see the economics of it and the government can do something more sensible, like spend that money building bridges or funding cancer research or something, instead of just building bombs that aren't intrinsically useful in terms of what they directly give us. All right, so that's what somebody who is sympathetic to him would think. Okay. So anyway, just back to the main story. So on the one hand, it seems crazy. How could it possibly be that entering a war, even putting aside the issue of the morality of killing people or whatever, but just building a bunch of bombs and things like that, that doesn't directly convey human happiness, right? That takes real resources that otherwise could have gone into making cars or making radios or nylon stockings, things like that, food. And so it's odd that how could it be that gearing up and producing all of this stuff that's ultimately just going to get blown up makes us, you know, fixes our economy. That's kind of odd. That's an odd result. So let me just walk through so you can see how someone could possibly think that. And so one major bit of evidence is what happens here with the unemployment rate. So you can see it peaked in 33 at 25% or so, and then you can see how it steadily fell and then jumped back up, just like I talked about, and that's the double dip, and then it fell pretty sharply, and you can see how, you know, once the war started for the U.S., the unemployment rate was pretty low. So that's one way of looking at it. So now let's just deal with this one. I'll show you the other one too. Okay, and this is the other Trump card, where somebody like Krugman is going to say, what are you guys, crazy? How can you possibly sit there and deny that government spending during World War II is what pulled the U.S. out of depression? So these are real GDP figures. Okay, so this is adjusted for prices, nominal prices. All right, and so you can see the great contraction. Actually, you can't see because my color. Let's see. I don't know if this is going to work. I don't know if you guys can see that, but so that's the great contraction. So the bar, the height of these bars represents the level of real gross domestic product in the U.S. for that year. So you can see it kept shrinking, and it bottomed out in 1933. And then you had this recovery up and then the double dip. And then look at that. It just takes off like crazy and then peaks at 44 and then starts falling. And then you can even see this fairly large drop from 45 to 46. And so obviously the war ended in 45. So that's why. And then especially if you compared the movements in this chart with the government's military spending, you would see, oh yeah, it fits like hand in glove. So here's, you know, Krugman, and he has said in print and, you know, a thing I assigned you guys and on TV that, oh yeah, of course we have a great historical episode of where massive government deficit spending pulled the economy out of a bad recession, namely World War II. Okay, so you can see here how it looks like a Keynesian could think, come on, this is an open and shut case. How can anybody even think about disputing this? So let me explain how Bob Higgs goes about dismantling this case. Now, it's not, some of the points I'm going to make here are not original to Bob Higgs, but a lot of them are. Okay, so that's why. And he's, in case you guys don't know, like, he actually published this stuff in peer-reviewed journal articles in sort of normal journals that weren't just Austrian stuff. You know what I mean? So among economic historians who are into this topic, I mean, Bob Higgs is a big figure. It's not just that he's a guy that Austrians like, and so that's why we pay attention to him, but the rest of the profession doesn't care. I mean, this is scholarly work that he did, original research to question the official consensus on World War II and the myth of wartime prosperity. Okay, so as far as the unemployment rate, well, yeah, it did go down. And then, but Higgs points out, well, why are we assuming that that is a good proxy for the health of the economy? Because that's kind of what people are implicitly meaning, whether they say it or not, that a falling unemployment rate is a good thing. And that makes sense because that's partly what we associate with a bad economy is unemployment's really high. And so then it seems like, well, how would we know the economy got fixed? Well, the unemployment rate would fall. So it's mistaking, in this case, a symptom for the actual cause, or to put it in other words, if the economy actually had been fixed or cured, then the unemployment rate would have fallen. That's true. But it doesn't mean because the unemployment rate fell that therefore the economy was healthy again. All right. So for this unemployment rate, I mean, Higgs points out, look at what the way FDR fixed it was, he drafted people and sent them overseas to kill and be killed. And so in what sense is that curing the problem of the unemployed? And in fact, if you look at the numbers, it wasn't even a one-to-one movement. In other words, they drafted more people in absolute numbers than the ranks of the unemployed fell, if that makes sense to you guys. You get what I'm saying? So it's like for every 100 people that they drafted and sent overseas, the population of unemployed job seekers did not fall by 100. It fell by less than 100. All right, so if they had just literally gone out to the people who were unemployed and just grabbed them all and put them on a boat and sent them across the ocean, that would have been more effective in terms of reducing the unemployment rate than what they ended up doing. And clearly, you can see how, if that is what they did, if the way they cured the problem of there being all these unemployed people was to just grab them all and put them on a boat and say, okay, now you got to go across the ocean and get shot at by a bunch of mean-looking Germans, nobody would say, oh, yeah, that you fixed the problem. The economy's better now. And yet what they did was even less efficient than that in terms of the numbers. Okay, so that's the way that Higgs attacks that, and you know, he does it in a very scholarly fashion and points to the data and so forth. Now, as far as what do you do about something like this, okay, there's two things going on here. So the first one is you got to decompose these figures. And so that's what I've done here, or disaggregate it. I don't know if you can read it on the slide, but this key over here says government and private. So the point is, in this slide, the green part is government, and the blue part is private. I'll just put a P for private. All right, so you can see what happened in the war years. And these lines here, 41 through 45, is that the reason the sum of those two figures rose so rapidly was that government spending just exploded. All right, so that's why the figures went up so fast, is because the way GDP is calculated, remember, the definition of GDP, it's private consumption, private investment, plus net exports, plus what? Government spending. And so as government spending went way up, other things equal, that's going to make GDP go up. All right, so let me make two points about this, and then I'm going to throw you an even subtler point. look at what happens to the private component of GDP. These blue charts or blue bars. You see how they actually went way down? And look at this. In 43 and 44, they were lower than they had. Well, I know it's lower in 44. I'm just eyeballing here. It looked like it was lower in 43 also, but I know in 44 it was lower. But my point is lower than even back in 32 and 33. Okay, so what that's saying is the amount of, again, we're taking even the numbers on their own face value. And then there's all kinds of problems that Austrians and even other economists have raised with the way that GDP is calculated. But again, my point is here, you can just take the numbers on their own face value, and you can see the private sector, the amount of goods and services actually going to consumers, and by the way, this isn't it's not just consumption. This is also in private investment too. Okay, so this is, it'd be this figure up here, or these things, private consumption and investment was lower at the height of World War II than it had been at the greatest depths of the Great Depression. So, and then when you think about it, look at all the time passage, right? That was more than a decade later. So that's astounding. And also, population was bigger. Okay, so when you factor those two things in, the fact that total real output using the government's own figures enjoyed by people in the private sector was lower than it had been in 32 and 33 is kind of shocking, because that means per capita was much lower. All right, so that's one way of, you know, so when we talk about wartime prosperity, it's certainly not that Americans felt rich. No, they were actually forced to have an incredibly Spartan lifestyle, standard of living, compared to what they had been used to. They were having to make do with less than even during the worst years of the Great Depression, again, using the government's own figures. So I think, when you try to understand, why then is there this perception that the economy was booming in 1943 and 44? Where does this myth even come from if the statistics are showing how poor they were? Well, there's two things. First of all, people had jobs, right, because they were going into the factories and building bombs and stuff, so they felt like they were employed. And I think they felt rich because they were, you were able to buy war bonds and stuff like that. Okay, so it was like they were, in their mind, accumulating wealth. It's just they weren't able to enjoy it at the moment. And why not? Well, because there's a war on, and there was rationing schemes imposed and so forth. So I think that's what was going on, that if that had just been peacetime, when things were like that in 32 and 33, and there was no reason for them to be that restricted in terms of what the private sector was producing, then, you know, psychologically, this is awful. This is the worst economy we've ever known about, whereas even though they were actually per capita enjoying less a decade later, it was in the midst of fighting this massive world war. And so, of course, you're not going to be worried about getting more eggs or getting a new radio set at that point, because, oh my gosh, our boys are overseas getting killed and trying to fight the Germans and the Japanese. So that, I think, explains how this could be, that actually their standard of living was lower using the official statistics, and yet there was this perception that actually the economy was booming, whereas in 32 and 33, the perception was this economy is totally broken. Okay, so that's one point to make. And I've taken this, so this isn't what Higgs says, I've taken this kind of point and elaborated on it and said, You know, it's interesting, even on his own terms then, somebody like Krugman can't really point to this as a model to be followed, right? Because Krugman's story of why the private sector was so restrained here, or constrained, is because of the official rationing. You know, because he dealt with this sort of objection, because people have looked at, like Robert Barrow and other economists have looked at the so-called multipliers and found that they weren't big during World War II, even though you should have thought they'd be off, you know, through the charts, off the charts, through the ceiling. And Krugman was like, well, that's dumb. Of course they didn't take off because there were rationing schemes imposed. All right, so again, you see that, you know, Krugman had to come up with an explanation for why his suggested policy didn't actually do what he now says it would do. Okay, so let me put it to you this way again. I'm just reframing the point I was making there. Strictly speaking, Krugman, if he wants to point to World War II as a way, as an example of what the Obama administration could have done to totally cure the recession, would have to say, oh, Obama could have spent so much money that U.S. standard of living in terms of the private sector would have gotten pushed down to, I think I ran the numbers, and it was like in 1987. Right? The government, the Obama administration could have spent so much money, could have run deficits that were so unimaginably huge that the private sector could have been squished down to the level it was in 1987. But look at all the government services we would get, because unlike World War II, we wouldn't be spending the money on bombs and stuff. We would be spending it on schools and bridges and vaccines and the space program. And so I pointed out, who would take that bargain? Let's concede that Krugman's right and that World War II is the model for how an economy works. Would anybody say, yeah, I want to go back to 1987 levels of private sector output in exchange for all of these government services? And I don't think anybody, well, I don't think many people would take it. Maybe unemployed people would. Okay, so that's what I'm saying. That even on his own terms, World War II isn't the smoking gun that Krugman thinks it is. Okay, now, the standard Keynesian response to this sort of thing is to say, you know, you guys are nutty. The issue is, how do you expand the economy? And GDP is GDP. And look at, we proved it. Look at that. How can anyone ignore this? So it's also relevant to say at this point, wait a minute, as flawed as GDP calculations are, and that whole methodology, there at least is some plausibility in adding up dollar amounts for what people voluntarily spend in the private sector, right? So even there's all kinds of methodological issues, right? So as an Austrian, I, of course, am not defending the GDP, you know, the figures they come up with. But the point is, if you want to say, hey, how much did this neighborhood consume versus this neighborhood over here, and this neighborhood bought a bunch of TVs, and this neighborhood over here bought a bunch of apples, and meaning fruit, and as opposed to laptops and stuff, and video games, and how do you compare apples and video games to TVs? Because they're just, you know, how do you do it? Well, you could say how many dollars do they spend? You know, that's the way you could look at the total dollar amount spent. Because everybody always has the option of spending their dollars on one thing or another, and so there's a loose sense in which you can kind of say, all right, if somebody spends $100 on something, then that thing was worth at least $100 to them, because he could have spent $100 on something else. Okay, fine. But even that doesn't work when it comes to government expenses. It's not the case that if the government spends $100 million buying tanks, that those tanks were worth $100 million, again, so even if you're putting aside the issues of what do you mean when you say worth $100 million, you know, that kind of stuff, there's a definite sense in which, okay, if the consumers spend $1 billion on cars, you could say, okay, there's at least $1 billion worth of output. Fine. That doesn't work if you say the government spends $100 million on tanks, so therefore there's $100 million worth of output. That doesn't work because just the institutional context is different. That those government officials, they're not free to spend that money on whatever they want. They can't just pocket it and go out and spend it on stuff in the private sector. All right, so the point is, you know, institutionally, in terms of corruption, whatever, this helps us understand why the government pays so much more for things than it needs to, right? If there were a free market defense, military hardware wouldn't cost as much as governments pay for it. And that's partly because of the reason I'm talking about right here, that the officials, if they save money by being careful shoppers, it's not like they get to pocket the money, because that would be considered corruption. They would be stealing public funds. So that's why they have an incentive to allow the government military contractors to give them bids that are way too high, because they're funneling extra money to those guys, so then when they leave office, they can be consultants or whatever. Right? So that's kind of how the system works. So the point is, when it comes to this issue of the GDP data for the war years, that actually is relevant. Forget, you know, it has nothing to do with the corruption of this, but I don't care about the corruption. I'm just saying, economically, you can't say government spending is the same thing as private sector spending. Because, so in other words, it's not correct to say that the height of this thing is just what the private sector would have done had the government not spent that money or something. You get what I'm saying? So the height, in other words, the height of these green bars is meaningless. Okay. So there's that issue. But now Bob Higgs brought up something else, and this was astounding to me. Let me first, to motivate this last point, and then I'll turn to your questions, let's look at what the Federal Reserve was doing at this time. Okay, so I'm progressively pulling back on these Fed charts. Remember, when we were talking about FDR's devaluation of the dollar in terms of gold, this thing looked like it was a big deal. Remember that? Because I zoomed way in on it, and I was like, whoa, look at that spike. And now that's, you can barely see that compared to this. So look what happens there. It really starts taking off in the late 30s. And then during the height of the war effort for the U.S. is when it just zooms way up. So what's going on is the federal government, of course, was running massive budget deficits. And so the Fed did what central banks do, and some would argue that's the whole point of having a central bank, is it's there to fund the government. And so that the Fed was indirectly monetizing all of these deficits by, you know, buying assets in the market, which then induced people to lend so much money to the government. So the point is, with all that inflation, there would have been massive increases in prices. But there weren't, because of price controls. Okay, so remember, this GDP data is real. This is what the government's statistics show as being actual output, because they've corrected for changes in prices. So let me just make sure you understand this point. It's kind of subtle, but it's crucial. Let's say you originally had an economy in nominal GDP was $1 trillion. Okay, so if you added up how much was spent on finished goods and services, it would all add up to $1 trillion. And then the central bank pumps in so much money that all the prices double. Okay, and there's just for simplicity, there's no changes in relative prices, there's no Cantillon effects and all that. It's just a doubling of everything. But the underlying real quantities haven't changed at all. It's just every sticker, every wage contract, all the numbers double. So next year, nominal GDP is $2 trillion. Now, the way they calculated, the government statisticians wouldn't be tricked. They would say, oh, nominal GDP is $2 trillion. Oh, but you know what? Prices have risen, so we have to change the GDP deflator. And since all prices doubled, once we doubled the deflator, and so now real GDP is still $1 trillion, just like it was last year. Okay, so you see how that works, that the way the real GDP figure wouldn't get distorted just by a bunch of inflation is if you corrected for the changes in prices. But now think of what happened during World War II. The Fed pumps in a bunch of new money, and then the federal government makes it illegal for prices to rise. So you've got all this extra money being used to purchase stuff, so, and that's pushing up nominal GDP, but yet the government is making it illegal for the prices to rise. So it's like they're pushing up the numerator but making it illegal for the denominator to rise, and then they're bragging about how big the quotient got, if you guys understood what I just said there, all right? So, part of the way that manifested itself, if you say, well, okay, but what does that mean? How does that translate into reality? Well, because it's not merely that here the standard of living was low compared to here. It was worse than these figures indicate, because here you also had to have ration coupons. You also had to wait in line to get stuff, whereas back here, that wasn't the case. I mean, yeah, there wasn't that much stuff to get, but you just needed dollars to get it. You didn't have to go wait in line. All right, so the point is these official statistics don't fully reflect actually how bad the economy was, and one way of understanding that is that if they hadn't had the price controls in place and just let prices rise, then these real GDP figures would be much smaller. Right, because the nominal figures would have been divided by bigger denominators, if you will, or the GDP deflator would have been bigger than what it actually is. So when I learned this point, I emailed Bob Higgs and I said, wait a minute, Bob, are you saying that when the government, when the Bureau of Labor Statistics and the Bureau of Economic Analysis, when they assemble these official series for what they call real GDP for these years, are you saying, in your opinion, they didn't adequately account for the fact that there were price controls during the war period, or are you saying they didn't even factor that in at all? And he wrote back and said they didn't even factor that in at all. They just calculated real GDP using a GDP deflator, taking the official prices as if they were the real market prices, even though they weren't. Those were, price controls that were placed that led to massive shortages. And those were the numbers that they plug in to then compute what the deflator was, and then they'd look at the nominal expenditures and divide by that artificially constrained deflator and say, wow, look at how big real GDP grew during the war years. So I hope I conveyed to you how illegitimate that technique is. And so when he said that to me, I was stunned. I had assumed he must have meant they corrected for it, but actually didn't really do it justice, and so ended up exaggerating. And he told me, nope, they didn't correct for it at all. Okay, last 5 minutes, let me look at your questions. Daniel Richardson says, is monetarist the same as supply side in Chicago school? Well, supply side in Chicago school are not necessarily the same thing. So that's one. So monetarist can't be, because those two things aren't necessarily the same thing. Monetarist arguably is, could be interchangeable with Chicago School, just because Milton Friedman is associated with monetarism in its sort of 20th century form, and he also was a famous Chicago School economist. Whereas, a lot of the same, somebody who is a Chicago School economist very likely is also a monetarist, and very likely also is a supply sider. I mean, so the terms are similar, but they're not literally interchangeable. Supply side tends more to be talking about that you think that tax policy has very large impacts on people's behavior. Whereas to be a monetarist, obviously, is focused more on what central bank policy is. So you could be a monetarist and not be a supply sider, but you're right. In practice, the two tend to be correlated. Okay, Benjamin says, could you address specifically what caused the Roosevelt Depression in 37 to 38? Keynesians offer the decreased spending theory, but I haven't heard opposing interpretations. Excuse me. Okay, so, I just remember now that you brought that up. I didn't spell out the, so the Keynesians will point to the fact that the Roosevelt administration tried to reduce the deficit, and so that's what they say. I've talked to you about what the monetarist views are. I've seen, if you wonder, okay, well then, how would you, Bob Murphy, explain it? I don't have something that I'm fully satisfied with, but there were a lot of things in terms of the New Deal, and because there were like with the executive branch fighting with the judiciary over the New Deal, things came out such that in this period, the government was able to strengthen unions, and nominal wages became much more rigid, or would increase in certain industries. So that's one thing I would say as to, why was it that things all of a sudden changed in this period? As I would say that the federal government's attempts to raise wages was strengthened, and to understand what changed, you'd have to go look at the history of their battles with the Supreme Court. So that's one thing that I think is a large factor. It's also, remember, I don't think that the monetarist story is wrong. It's just I take a different lesson from her conclusion. Just like if Ron Paul had been elected and did all the stuff that his Austrian supporters wanted him to do, the economy would have crashed, right? There would have been an awful, a depression. The point, though, is that it would have been ended pretty quickly, and then it would have been paved the way for a very solid recovery and genuine expansion, whereas I think what they've been doing is just postponing the inevitable and going to make it that much worse. Okay, so it's for the Fed to have doubled reserve requirements, I don't feel the need to try to say, oh no, that didn't do anything. That shows why you don't want to have fractional reserve banking in the first place, right? Because it sets you up for a crash. Okay, Daniel Richardson says, he kind of is asking the same thing. And then last one here, Jeff Bream says, isn't the Austrian objection to Krugman's point here definitional? A GDP number that includes government spending is not synonymous with the health of the economy. Yeah, right. I mean, that is one way of putting it, but I wanted to walk you guys through the various subtleties of the argument. It's not merely that. In other words, I don't even need to use that point. I can take this data at face value and say, according to government's own figures, even if you think a dollar of government spending is just as legitimate a measure of economic output as a dollar of private spending, even so, look at what happened in this historical case, that private standards of living got squished to being lower than they were at the worst levels of the Great Depression during this so-called, you know, solution of mass government deficits. So that's why, I mean, so you're right, Jeff, but I don't want to put all my eggs in that one basket, because the problem with their story is even worse than just that methodological objection. Okay. We're over time here. I see some people are putting some questions in the chat box, so I will catch up on those online on the typing it up. And thank you, everyone, for taking the course. I hope you learned something, and I will see some of you perhaps tomorrow in the office hours sessions, and I will next week post the quiz and then give you a heads up as to when the final exam will be posted also.